Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Adam Roberts, Senior Research Fellow at this university in International Relations, and I have probably less direct experience, though I do have some, of UN humanitarian action in the field than almost all of you here, but I do write about the subject, and I've got the bed of nails of doing a brief summing up at the end. Before we get to the topic at hand, I have a very important announcement to make about taxis, or rather taxi in the singular, I think. There is one departing at 5:45 outside this building and going to the railway station, please be ready for it, as it cannot park there. So that's just four. There are four people. I think you probably know your names, but Maggie Herity, Judith Rowbotham, Fiona Tate, and Tina Micklethwaite are the lucky four. If anybody else thinks they're in a taxi, that's their problem.
It's not very humanitarian.
We've got the easy bit in this session. What has our experience taught us? Lessons for future policy. We've got to guide us two people who have served, both of them, as UN... Yes, great. Both of whom have served as humanitarian coordinators. Michael has served in Somalia, among other countries, and Afghanistan. And you've served in Somalia and various other states as well. Both Randolph has been deeply involved in thinking about the future of the UN. Both of them have come from London, where they work, respectively at Chatham House and the King's College. I'm looking forward very much to what they're going to say in answer to the difficult summary of this session's topics that is on the programme. I'll first ask Michael to speak and then turn to Randolph.
Well, thank you, Adam. And first of all, let me congratulate the organisers of this. I think it's just been a terrific day, and it's a terrific idea as well. And I feel really honoured to be, and somewhat intimidated, to have been asked to make some remarks. Yes, I don't think I'm going to repeat what I just said. One of the interesting things about the UN is that everybody has a particular pathway through it. Very unique pathways, and you tend to be strongly influenced by your earliest experiences in the UN. But in a way, we kind of all end up at this stage more or less with a similar panorama. I think I would like to make three propositions. I'll set them out and then I'll speak to them. And this is in answer to the exam test, which is what has our experience taught us and lessons for future policy. The first one is that humanitarian crises cannot be resolved by humanitarian actors alone. The second is that the era of independent and essentially Western humanitarian action may be over, but it is not clear yet what is going to replace it. And thirdly, that to retain our sanity and effectiveness, we must remain focused on responding to needs in a very practical and principled way. That is, I think, the best guide in terms of trying to organise ourselves going forward. So let me speak to the first one, that humanitarian crises cannot be resolved by humanitarian actors alone. And I mean, some of these are prompted by what's been said today, and some of them are as a result of just of thinking about these things in the past. I mean, I think humanitarians do face a dilemma, because on one hand, humanitarians are enjoined to behave in a highly principled, independent, if not, impartial, if not neutral, principled manner, and that their acceptability will depend in large part upon that. On the other hand, we cannot, as humanitarians, not draw connections between humanitarian crises and all the things that bring them about, including human rights abuse, catastrophic failures of policy, inequality, bad development, and all the rest of it. So, you know, someone has to say that the emperor is naked. Does it compromise us as humanitarians to do that, our impartiality, independence, neutrality, and all the rest of it? Or what is the way of doing that, especially when you are in the heat of the action? I mean, it's one thing doing this in academic seminars, but it's another thing doing it when you're in the thick of the action. And the example, as this is a witness seminar, I would like to give is Syria, where I have a very peripheral responsibility. But nevertheless, I've been asked to facilitate a series of meetings of the UN country team around the issue of protection, which takes me to Beirut on a fairly regular basis. And through that process and through following the whole Syria thing, I mean, I would make a number of observations. First of all, you know, this conflict is a crisis of protection. It's a crisis of protection that has been complicated by the fact that it is also now a proxy conflict. And somebody was saying that it's extremely important to consult with the people you are trying to help if you are going to shape your agenda for helping them. And if you ask Syrians, and various people have done this in perhaps not terribly scientific ways, what they most want, if humanitarians ask them, they will say, we want to stop the violence, we want to stop the barrel bombs, we want to stop the torture, we want to stop the disappearances, and we want access by us to services. Not so much access by humanitarian organisations, but we need to be able to move around. Well, this is quite an agenda, and it's not as if humanitarians are in a position to do much about this agenda. So what it immediately suggests is that a much broader group of actors is required if you are going to address what people themselves consider to be their most fundamental problems. And if, it gets worse than that, because let me give you a particular cynical explanation, which is in the media, so as to what is going on in Syria, just one aspect of it. Not only do we have egregious breaches of international humanitarian law all round, including by member states, we may have a situation in which the Russians are not unhappy about all the problems that very large numbers of people leaving Syria are creating for Western countries, because it is increasing the price that the West is having to pay for this engagement. And the Americans may at the moment, one interpretation is, I'm not saying it is the correct interpretation, may be giving the Russians as much rope as possible to hang themselves in Syria through this latest intervention. And if either of these is true, or if there is a smidgen of truth in it, what essentially is happening is people are being used in the most cynical way. Now, what do humanitarians do about that? On the one hand, we have to soldier on. You know, you have to do what you have to do. But humanitarians cannot solve this humanitarian problem. You need a much, much broader group of actors. And this becomes a very big issue. Whose responsibility is it to mobilize that broader group? Does the UN have the reach, the creativity, the capacity to do that? My second proposition is that the era of independent and essentially Western humanitarian action may be over, but we're not sure what will replace it. And this is partly prompted by 48 hours of breathing in the oxygen in Geneva with Martin at the and Mukesh and probably half the people in the room at the World Humanitarian Summit. And it may be over for good as well as for bad reasons. Good reasons might be a recognition that the main humanitarian actors are local people. They are the ones who take the strain. That you need to engage beneficiaries and communities. As the foreign minister of Switzerland said, voice and choice are fundamental. That you need to engage different constituencies, including women, most obviously, much more than we do. Then that you need much greater accountability to the people who you're trying to help. And there's also perhaps a desire in many countries to use local and national capacities and regional if they're pushed, but certainly not the idea that they have to bring in Thunderbird 3, 4 and 5 from wherever. So maybe those are slightly positive reasons. Some of the negative reasons include a lack of understanding of the NGO world, of the humanitarian world, of Western actors. I think Lamise was speaking to that. Where is she? Operational difficulties and risks for international actors, which are having all sorts of strange consequences. Suspicion of the motives of humanitarian organisations, given where their money comes from and the funding. And that Western humanitarian principles are not necessarily as understood or as accepted, even if they are understood, as we would like to think. They are contested, I think. Maybe they're misunderstood. So, you know, the idea of the World Humanitarian Summit, and I defer to Martin on this, but I think is to try and reaffirm the universality of humanitarian principles and all the rest of it. But I think this is quite a tough call. And in Geneva, I was trying to look out for Pakistanis and Chinese and, you know, Sudanese, and they were quite thin on the ground. And I just hope that as we do this, the genuine universality dimension is emphasized, and that voices of non-Western humanitarians are fully engaged in one last comment on this one is I'm very struck by what Michael Mosselman said, which I interpret as essentially we are having an increasingly bulk approach to problems which require very local and granular solutions because of pressures on donors and all the rest of it. And it does raise the issue as to whether, you know, in the last session, someone saying surprised how lightly states have got off. To what degree are donor countries actually responsible for prolonging the life of a system which may have reached its sell-by date? And where does the impetus lie? Well, what are the possibilities if we really do want to change things? Do we need to try and appeal to enlightened Western donors to do this? Or where do we start? I mean, how do you do it? Do you start with the Chinese, Indians and Brazilians? Or do you start with the donors and say, let's adopt a different approach? My third proposition is that we've got to remain focused on the practical, principled action. And here I would go to my experience in Afghanistan, where I was very lucky to have a terrific team at OCHA. So I cannot claim credit for this, and claiming credit for anything in Afghanistan is a perilous thing to do. But I have to say that for a couple of years, we had a very positive experience in the humanitarian community, because what we managed to try and persuade, well, what we I think we managed to persuade everyone to do, including the government, local and national, including the NGOs, including the UN, including the Red Cross, was to say, let's adopt a three-step approach. First, have a shared assessment of what the humanitarian situation is. You know, who are we talking about? What are their needs? And so on. And I won't bore you with the details, but we reached quite a high degree of consensus as to what the nature of the problem was. Secondly, we tried, and we didn't complete this, to get a handle on who had the capacities to respond to this. Were the capacities local? Were they national? You know, what about the military? What about the, you know, and so on. And the third thing was, you know, what resources are actually available, financial and otherwise, to deal with this. And this forced a process of discussion and prioritization, which was imperfect, but certainly had a degree of momentum. And I would say, just in conclusion, that, you know, I probably would say this, that I think only the UN can lead that process. And it is a validation of the role of the UN. No one else has the legitimacy and the connections and the experience to engage such an extraordinarily diverse group of actors, including local people right through to four-star American generals, to non-traditional donors, to traditional donors, and all the rest of it. So I do think the UN has a fundamentally important role in bringing coherence, coordination may be too much, but coherence to UN action in the humanitarian sphere. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to sit up, stand up here.
Yeah, please.
Thank you very much. And for the record, I'm Randolph Kent. What I'd like, first of all, to do is to thank you very much for having the opportunity to be here, and if I can thank Edward and Martin in particular. I'd also like to just mention something before my own few remarks, and that is this whole issue that Angela Raven Roberts mentioned at the outset of this meeting. Whatever the criticisms, whatever the failings of the system, there are extraordinary amounts of people who are our colleagues, our former colleagues, who have made such extraordinary sacrifices. So my remarks, if you like, are about a system, not about people that we all know. That said, in my witness brief, I mentioned three situations that, Alan, you're missing the best part.
It's a walkout. It's a walkout.
I didn't mean it. Forgive me. I mentioned three issues that I think is very relevant to what we've discussed today, and I think it's also very relevant to the future. I mentioned Rwanda as an adaptive failure. The fact of the matter is that what we did is to provide the food and clothing, medicine, shelter, but after a genocide, did we not provide psychological support, trauma counseling and mental health clinics, etc.? How sensitive were we to the needs of people? How aware, how anticipatory, how adaptive were we? I think the second issue that I raised in my witness brief is the whole in from Kosovo, the emerging realities about coordination. Let me just say that one of the things that I'd like to talk about is not coordination, but collaboration. Coordination has been tried, and I think it has many weaknesses. But try collaboration from a most peculiar initial starting point. How about humanitarian assistance and collaboration from mutual self-interest? How about an assessment of who has comparative advantages and who has value added? And that's my Kosovo experience. And let me touch on Somalia. Somalia was an extraordinary opportunity to try and innovate, particularly under the conditions. What was fascinating is the way the structure, the way the system put hindrances in front of even minimal kinds of approaches to innovation. So what I'd like to do is to take all this past experience, take what we've all been through in this very, very good meeting today, and ask you this. In 20 years' time, there's going to be a BAFUNC meeting again. And all of you, because you're all invited, will perhaps live in this kind of world. First of all, the types, dimensions, and dynamics that we talk about in humanitarian crises will be significantly different. There is a cybernetic failure, which has now turned down all sorts of systems, everything from food and all that cash that you want to transmit by phones, mobile phones, etc., are gone. Superbugs that are unable to be dealt with by conventional medicines. The whole question of the interface between technology and natural hazards. The whole question of, and this is something which we haven't touched on, but which the UN has to understand, the potential of extraordinary global inequalities amongst not merely the what we used to call, and hopefully will stop calling, the developing world and the developed world. So these are the kind of vulnerabilities that I think we'll have to see. So my question to you is, where in that United Nations will the knowledge come from? What is an adaptive organization? Is the United Nations an adaptive organization? Is it anticipatory? To what extent does it give itself time to think about the what might be's? Google, whiteboard, outside its offices, anybody can write whatever ideas they might have. These ideas are taken seriously. What is the UN's whiteboard? Let me also say that in thinking about the what might be's, you know, time and time again, and Michael, I kept hearing about local, and my own involvement with the World Maritime Summit was also local. I want to ask you what local is in the 21st century. Is local the atomized society? Is local the question of social networking, networking? What is local now? Let me ask you this. Who were the victims, the potential victims of local when it comes to Ebola? What are the dividing lines? What do you mean by local as you look in 10 or 15 years from now? And I just wonder, in that same sense, if you take a look at what the UN and how it's structured. We are, as has been, I think, reminded throughout the day in one way or another, a state-centric system. But change is happening too quickly. The speed of change is changing institutions extraordinarily. States have not proven their capacity to keep up with change. The private sector has. Networks have now given in a whole new dimension of authority, of distribution, etc., to states. Or should the United Nations begin to see the concept of state as something far larger than what we saw in 1945? And let me just mention perhaps something which is sort of strange, but let me say it anyway, irresistible. And that is, when we talk about states, when we talk about vulnerability, when we talk about our responsibility, let me just come up with a very brief phrase. Cyberspace, outer space, and human space. What will our responsibility be in 10 or 15 years? Virtually all our cyberspace will be based in outer space systems. If you take a look at what I believe the UN's Fourth Committee on Special Political and Decolonization said on the 14th of October 2014, they said, we know that more and more governments, countries will be in outer space, but we hope that they will not take advantage of us. 13 countries have control of outer space, which in turn perhaps can be seen as the center, the source of control over so much of what we know now. And is this a kind of neo-imperialism? Where does the United Nations fit in here? And where does the United Nations fit into a system in which, for all intents and purposes, it can find data, can anticipate, things that we had never thought before? So, for example, we talk about refugees and what the amounts are. NASA has come up with a program which can begin to start anticipating refugee movement. So my question is, to what extent is the United Nations an anticipatory organization as it looks to the future? Let me then conclude with the following, and that is, what is the UN's and what will be the UN's value added? And we keep struggling about the UN as an organization and its organizational dynamics and its failure, but really there's a far more important universe out there. And I'd like to say that the UN increasingly has become a forum for the future. That it has to back away, I believe, from this operational role, which adds extraordinary confusion and complications to its interests and to its value. I would like to see a UN that has far greater anticipatory capacities and shares them with member states or shares them globally. So with all the agencies and programs that the United Nations has, can't it begin to identify future vulnerabilities, the sorts of things that we should be preparing for, at least thinking about, the sorts of preparedness measures that really will deal with the kind of crises, not of yesteryear, but of the future. I'd like to see a UN which really begins to say it's not about coordination, but it is, if you like, ensuring that there are links to collaboration, that I can actually find ways that you can determine the value added, the comparative advantages, the self-interest of groups who actually want to work in countries to assist the afflicted. I think it would be tremendous if the United Nations took all its resources, its programs, its agencies, etc., and began to take a look at the sorts of innovations that one might need and use to really find solutions to the kind of problems that we have. Right now, if I listen to what we've gone through, the United Nations seems to be very unresponsive. Unresponsive in terms of anticipating, being adaptive. Right now, if I understand what you're saying, it sees too many constraints in terms of its delivery systems and its ability to form and bring together different actors. And certainly in terms of innovation, if you take a look at what we do and what we call innovation, it's incremental adjustment from where we are. And the next meeting that we will have of this organization in 20 years' time will be looking at problems and will require solutions that are far different from the kind of things we're positing today. Thank you very much.
We have half an hour for discussion of these two remarkable presentations, or indeed of other issues that have come up today. Who's going to be first? Yes, David Stephen.
Hello, my name is David Stephen. I was speechwriter, to Boutros Ghali and held various positions in the field. I think before we answer the question, what has our experience taught us, we really do have to answer Michael's question about whether we're at the end of an era, and everything has to be rethought, or whether it's simply a system under strain, which, subject to reforming and increased resources, can carry on as just before. And I think I'm inclined now, really to be convinced otherwise, to think that we are at the end of an era. And Randolph mentioned the extremes of poverty and wealth in the world. That's what's creating the push of refugees. State collapse is motivating it. Always used to be said, before 1962, we had an open door policy to Commonwealth immigrants in this country. But the British controlled who left the colonies at that stage, so nobody came, or very few people came. And then after those countries became independent, great flows started, and we had Commonwealth immigration legislation. Something very similar on the world scale is happening, with countries like Libya unable to carry on with the deals they'd apparently agreed with, I think, the Blair government, to stop people leaving. Now there's no single government able to do that. That seems to me to raise all sorts of issues. And in addition, the major challenge in the Middle East is to an organization which, among other things, champions the end of the Sykes-Picot system. It's actually explicitly, I mean, the first thing they said when they went into Iraq, and many people in the West didn't understand what they were talking about, but they said to the aides, we bring the end of Sykes-Picot. And that leads me to another point. Is the UN ready to face challenges such as major ethnic issues? And that, I don't think we've heard mention of that, but the peculiar fanaticism and rage which deprived people with an ethnic grievance bring to these conflicts is, I think, new. It means that it's very hard to establish impartiality because countries of one ethnic nation sit alongside countries of other on the UN, so you can be represented by either side as being against them. Just a few thoughts, thank you.
Thank you very much. Martin, the front here.
Marjorie Barber, formerly various jobs in the UN. I'm not going to try to answer any of the questions, but I just want to throw in a couple of additional points. First, I don't think anybody yet has mentioned the Sustainable Development Goals. And I think that this is actually rather an astonishing achievement. And if you read the declaration to which all member states signed up, it's the first time that development goals have been linked by everybody, including Chinese and Russians, everybody, to the idea of peace. And this has, in fact, almost by definition, reset the relationship between humanitarians, development professionals, and peace builders, for example, in ways which I think we don't yet foresee fully. And this is illustrated by some of the discussions at the World Humanitarian Summit over the last couple of days, and indeed over the last couple of years. And I'd just like to say a couple of things about the World Humanitarian Summit. And first is that this really very remarkable consultative process, which has been going on, I think, for just over 18 months, which has involved consultation meetings in 9 different regions of the world, has brought people together who would never otherwise have met, and has thrown up ideas about ways of working together on particular issues that would not have come to the fore if this process had not been taking place. Many of these initiatives will be put into effect whether or not the World Humanitarian Summit actually takes place in Istanbul in May next year, or irrespective of what happens from now on. But in addition to that great flowering of new thinking and new ways of working together, particularly at local levels and regional levels, I think that the consultations have also thrown up a small number of really quite big issues, some of them involving conceptual shifts, and those are illustrated by the discussions that we've just listened to, the presentation we've just listened to, where an initiative by the Secretary General to push some of these relatively big ideas forward will be important. So I hope that the Secretary General's report to the World Humanitarian Summit, when it comes out, will focus primarily on this small number of quite significant initiatives which need to be taken by the system as a whole. The last thing I want to say, and I hope I'm not going to sort of preempt something you were intending to say anyway, is that I think the witness brief format has provided people with an opportunity to get into this discussion, their ideas on a number of very interesting topics. And I think we have decided, Edward, if you agree, that we'll hold it open for another month or so. So that do feel free to continue to submit witness briefs. And if you want to expand the idea of the format a bit and just use it to send in an idea that you think ought to be considered in relation to these discussions, please do.
Thank you. Nikki Dahrendorf.
Thank you very much. I just have 3 quick points. Sorry, my name is Nikki Dahrendorf, for the record. Michael, you talked about the end of an era, and that's fine, and I think everybody's talking about the system isn't fit for purpose, we need to move on, and we've done a huge amount of bashing today, I think, about all the things that don't work. And I think, and some of us have been to a number of meetings where it's nothing new. We've heard a lot of the problems. We've identified a lot of the problems before. My question is really, you know, it's the end of an era, but does the era really know it's over? You know, do we, what needs to be done to be very clear that we're moving on to the next stage? So I'm just putting that question out there, not expecting an immediate answer, because I think people have a different perception of what's going on, particularly those working on the ground, as opposed to those who are sitting in New York or Geneva, and I think there's a real difference. The second point, just, it's about, we talk about the UN, and a lot of you are talking about the lack of anticipatory capacity, thinking ahead, looking ahead, being able to deal with all, with the present, or its inability to deal with the present, and therefore the difficulty of looking into the future. But we talk about the UN as a whole. It's not a monolith. There are so many different parts of it that make it up, and they actually often work against each other. Mm. You know, they don't all work along the same track. And I think maybe what we need to do is be a little bit more specific and nuanced about who are we targeting with this discussion that we're having. And third point, again, sorry, back to Michael. You talked about the shared assessment of the humanitarian situation. Again, this is happening, isn't it? I mean, there's quite a lot of those efforts and processes are ongoing. And actually, some of the analyses, at least some I've been involved with, are pretty sound. What's the problem? Why hasn't that gained more traction? Why has that not quite worked? I don't know the answer either. I just want to put it out there. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, Richard Jolly. Yeah.
Richard Jolly, just a thought. If we were talking development, I think the end of an era is marked very considerably by the dynamism of China and other Asian countries that have raised all sorts of new possibilities from their own experience and from their interaction with other parts of the world, but particularly in Africa. And I just feed that thought in with the question, it's not just for us, it's how do the BRICS, how do the other countries see humanitarian action in the next phase? I very much go along with Michael's very good presentation of the three issues, but I wish we could get some BRICS members to help answer.
You'd have to change the name of Bafunks to Babrickunks.
Yeah. Well, that's a thought, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
Maggie Herity, speaking as an entirely personal individual, doesn't occur to me that any of the BRICS has got a particularly good record in terms of human rights or equality, looking at what's going on in South Africa, the huge disparities in income in Brazil, not to mention China. So having them involved, I must say, gives me the cold shudders.
While you're composing any further questions, I don't know if you want to respond to any of those points that have been raised.
I'm not sure that there were. I mean, there were more in the shape of comments than sharp questions, I think. But, you know, I mean, I think Nikki's point, my reaction to it is to say, of course, there's incredible humanitarian work going on by very brave people all around the world, all the time. And there is a tendency to focus on not what is not working rather than what is working. And that's only natural when you get a group of people together at meetings like this. Probably because otherwise you'd have a sort of, you know, mutual admiration thing. But there is a profounder side to this, which is that, you know, in trying to understand what humanitarian needs are and what the capacities are to meet them, what we're not very good at is figuring out what works and building on that. What we're much better at is figuring out the deficits and then trying to respond to them. And what do I mean by that? I mean that, in a way, effective humanitarian action is so effective that it drops off the kind of humanitarian radar screen in some ways. Do you see what I mean? That it's a bit like good prevention. You don't notice it because it's worked. So there is a sort of tendency to focus on what doesn't work rather than what does work. I mean, I couldn't agree more with what Richard's point about how do the BRICS and others see humanitarian action, and I think that is looking at Martin. That's part of the idea of the World Humanitarian Summit, and I may have missed them, and I'm looking at Mukesh as well here, but I don't know how involved the Chinese, Indians, South Africans, Brazilians, and everybody else are in all the consultations that have taken place. It would be just interesting to know. Maybe there's a degree of anxiety by them of being involved, or maybe their involvement, I don't know. It's just a very good question. I mean, is the World Humanitarian Summit, you know, an opportunity for genuine consultation with both governments and civil society for those countries, or is that proving to be very, very difficult? Because if it is difficult, it's an indication of how still very Western the whole notion of humanitarian action remains. One thing I just wanted to add is this point about doing needs assessment. I mean, I just flipped through it. Why the experience I had in Afghanistan about doing needs assessment was so enlightening for me is because if you take the trouble, and I'm glad, Nikki, that you know it's good in many parts of the world, but I have been into a number of situations in which it just isn't good. But you know, if you take the trouble to try and understand the nature of the humanitarian problem, it does trigger thinking about what kind of partnerships and actions are required to deal with them. So, for example, broadly speaking, in Afghanistan, we got everyone to agree that there were three groups of people, very imperfectly. First, those directly conflict-related, and that triggered a whole load of things that you got to do, you know, IDPs and wounded and all that. The second were people who were affected by sudden disasters of one kind or another, and there was a whole agenda around that, or, you know, planning and rivers and, you know, earthquake kind of anticipation. And the third group was people who are living in absolute chronic poverty, who every 2 years slip into a situation in which... And that was a whole other agenda involving development actors and so on. So if you take the trouble to really assess what's going on and to get a shared understanding, which can take time because... You know, a number of actors aren't used to doing this kind of thing. And if you go through that, then I think it's a fantastic basis for building, you know, genuine partnerships and plans of action. And I, in my experience, and as I've said at the very beginning, everybody has different experience, but in my experience, we often just skim over that bit because there's so many pressures, you know, to get the money or there's the politics. I mean, I was at a breakfast once with a minister of development from a very important donor country being given a presentation on when Afghanistan would be financially self-sustainable. And he looked at the graph and he said to the World Bank guy who was giving the presentation, he said, can't you move it forward a bit? And the guy had spent sort of 18 months with a team of 25 people working this out. And the minister's reaction was, can you move the graph forward? Because it doesn't suit us politically that the country won't be self-sustaining until 2024. We need it to be self-sustaining in 20... You know, I mean, there are so many pressures that compromise integrity when it comes to trying to get a common assessment of what's going on. So I think it's really that stage of things is very important.
Randall.
And just very briefly, I think this point about does the era know it's over... It's fascinating because I'd put it another way. I'd put it, the era, in a sense, is over and everything is changing and we have very little control unless we completely change the way we do, the kind of objectives we have, etc. So that's one thing. You know, what works is a fascinating formula because we always look for what works in terms of incremental adjustments to what we already know. I think we have to change the way we look at what works and look what works for others, what works for the private sector, what works for sciences, what works for all groups that perhaps have very little relationship with what you might call the humanitarian sector. So I think what works maybe does not start with where we normally look. I think the other issue that I just wanted to mention was this whole question of anticipatory capacity. In one sense, it's not a system as a whole, as Nikki very rightly said. All I'm saying is, if we as, if you like, a UN body want to have value added, it's going to be less and less than what we used to do, the good old operations stuff, the data collection, which can be done in a thousand different, far more sophisticated ways. And far more, we have to tell the global community what might be the vulnerabilities that they have to begin to consider, and what are the ways to deal with them, because that is the major gap globally. And I haven't seen anyone fill that, and I certainly haven't seen the UN do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Judith Robos from Plymouth University. As a historian, one of the things that has struck me with the comments that have been made about the end of an era is that eras rarely end tidily. And I think that in considering whether or not we may be at the end of an era, it's a question of trying to identify what is likely to last into any future era. One of my students once told me that the Middle Ages slumbered to a halt and the Renaissance bolted in from the blue. But in fact, we're talking as if precisely that is going to happen. The new era is going to bolt in from the blue. It isn't. And we need, in the considerations that we're looking at here, to think about what is likely, both problematically and advantageously, to last into a new era from this previous era of Western-dominated intervention.
Thank you. Yes, Edward.
Thank you, Edward Mortimer. I just want to push back against Randy's idea a bit. The UN that I have seen doesn't seem to me very well adapted to do this kind of anticipatory thing. I think there are reasons why that happens in the private sector and why it happens in the sciences. The UN, I think, can usefully gather together ideas. I don't think it's very particularly likely to produce them. Richard will say, but there are all these wonderful, the intellectual history of the UN and so on and so forth. But I think essentially it was that. It was that the UN pulled these things together. And the SDGs, say what you like about them, they are an attempt at that, to look 15 years ahead and say, this is what the world is going to be like and these are the kind of things we're going to need. Whether they actually measure up to the reality, I don't know. But I think that the capacity to anticipate the kind of radical change that he's talking about will not come from an organisation, and certainly not from an interstate organisation. It will come from individuals and teams working, maybe in universities, maybe in companies or wherever. But we need the UN as a place where these ideas can be brought together and somehow we can decide what the hell we might have to do about them.
Professor Kapila. Yeah.
Thank you for still being allowed to speak. After all my elbows. On the BRICS, I think, as a sort of ex-BRICky person, what I would say is we should not romanticize about it. Someone has already said, quite honestly, what is shocking to see is India's and China's development silo, which is what I know quite a bit about, of their development policies, making the same old mistakes as the Western donors did. And that's a tragedy. That's sad. And when you talk to them, when you confront them, as you know, I'm not backward in confronting people, when I confronted Beijing and Delhi on these matters directly, with the relevant people, they say, well, if it was good enough for you, why is it not good enough for us? So don't tell me about that we are exploiting South Sudan's oil or not taking part in whatever influence we have. So that's one thing. Now, actually, the hopeful thing is civil society in these countries is very much alive and kicking. And someone was reading some statistics, they said every 200th person in India is an NGO, I mean, belongs to an NGO or something. They seem to be, like there's 65 million gods, there seem to be 65 million NGOs in India. Maybe the NGOs are the new gods, I don't know. But and they are very much involved in the summitary process of the World Humanitarian Summit. We certainly have had many submissions from NGOs across all the world, and India's China's included in all this. However, if the question is of the government's involvement, then I think it's a bit of an open question. And, I think there is everything to go for in terms of trying to influence. On the second point of this era business, whether or not we'll end an era, sir, I don't know. I mean, whether or not we're ending an era, whether it's whimpering or whatever it's doing. But what I do know of the next era, that the best way to anticipate the future is to invent it. So what that means is that I get impatient with trying to collect data and trying to say, oh, well, if we do this, we do that, etc. Well, if we have, and I go back to the issue of a moral future, if there is some preferred policy objective, whether it's the SDGs, which are, by the way, I think are brilliant, a great advance on the MDGs, because the MDGs were invented by Mark Malik Brown and his photocopying machine in New York. And he'll tell you the story himself in a much more entertaining way. While the SDGs were a very untidy consultative process, that's why there's 17 of them, because you can't reduce the world's problems down to 5 or 10. So I think they're brilliant. But I think the thing about the future is, I don't know what the future is going to bring or not, but I do know what the future I want to live in, for as long as I live, and certainly my descendants, you see. And I think the debate and discussion should be about inventing the future, rather than preparing for the future. Why not take the future in your hands, in our hands? It is perfectly possible, whether it's technologically possible or whether it's ideologically possible. And I see quite a lot of the futurology debate. Sorry, Randolph, I know you made a career out of this, very successful one, of inventing the future, planning for the future. Is why are we still talking about the future? Why are we not in the future already? And of course, outside the UN, outside aid circles, people are already moving into that particular future. So I want us to move forward into the future we want.
I think we will do that one way or another. Terry Jones. Yes, up there.
As a practitioner, I obviously reflect on 4 decades in the UN that I'm more of a part of the problem than the solution. But since I retired in 2008, I've had more of an opportunity to look at how the system functions at the country level. And I think it's full of innovation. I think there are tremendous stories that many untold, unfortunately, that's one of the problems, but many are told. Those of you who watched yesterday, the Secretary General presenting himself in a videotape to the World Comic Congress and showing how he can put the world to rights in a very, very persuasive way. Superman, I guess, is one of the ways. Shows that, in fact, the system, it does change. The system does move forward and tries to adapt, tries to... And in fact, in UNDP, we have a global centre in Singapore which helps bureaucracies to think about the future and what... how they should be, in fact, planting that foot forward. We've supported, I think, in the last few years, some 25 countries to look 50 years ahead, 30 years ahead. So there's a lot, and as somebody pointed out, there's so much going on, it's difficult to really capture it. What worries me is that, in fact, we also know from our own experience and a lot of efforts at reform that the system is, in fact, on the brink of collapse in many ways, and whether it's the funding perspective, whether it's the pressure to reduce staffing costs. And it seems to me member states have not stepped up, they've not recognized the need for systemic reform, because we all know there's so many opportunities to make that happen, not to destroy the good parts of the system, but really to optimize their contribution. Finally, I felt in the presentations, one elephant in the room that has not been mentioned is the Security Council. Now, I guess that may be the topic for your witness seminar in January, but it seems to me if that issue is not solved, that a lot of this talk about humanitarian futures and development futures are going to be constrained. And as somebody pointed out, I mean, as Michael, I think, pointed out in Syria, you know, if by proxy people are being subjected to humanitarian crises to serve geopolitical ends in some future scenario that Putin and others are contemplating, then the Security Council is a big elephant in the room.
Thank you. Michael, do you want to...
Well, just very, very quickly. I mean, I think implicit in some of the things we're saying is that politicians, national politicians, are demonstrating their inability to come to terms with problems that go well beyond national boundaries and that require responses in timeframes which are kind of alien to them. I mean, maybe that's being slightly unfair, but on the whole, and yet they're not prepared to invest in robust, mechanisms, intergovernmental, regional mechanisms that might help them. I mean, we've got pretty well everywhere, in the European Union, we've got tremendous problems. I mean, the gridlock in the Security Council is, my understanding is, it's worse now than it pretty well ever has been. I turn to Edward. I mean, maybe there's been a period in which it's been worse than it is now, but it's pretty terrible. And I haven't been to New York for a couple of months, but people are saying it's just appalling. The atmosphere. Let me just. I just think your point about telling stories is very important. And in a way, we haven't. I think we've touched upon this ever so slightly, but a dream scenario is one in which the UN is much better at telling stories about what is going on in the world and what needs to be done to address those problems. And I think one of the great things about the UN is it's such a sort of loose organization that you do constantly have constellations of people coming together at unlikely moments and in unlikely places and doing absolutely amazing things. But as a system, we are not really telling a compelling story, I don't think, about what's going on in the world. And that is a big problem. And, some people say, oh, it's because, this SG doesn't have particularly strong communication skills. That's probably unfair. But I have to say, if there was an SG who was a powerful communicator, then I think that would make a very big difference. And the ability to tell stories about all the work it's doing is desperately needed. So, I think bottom line is that UN has the legitimacy and the positioning to do absolutely amazing things. Whether it's got the wherewithal, organizational capacity, leadership and motivation to do that is another matter.
As long as it's stories and not fibs.
As long as it's what?
Stories and not fibs.
And not fibs, yeah. Yeah.
Just... Oh, very briefly, Maggie.
Thank you, Maggie Herity, and apologies to people at the BAFAX London lunch yesterday because I made the same point to the speaker there. Apart from telling stories, I think also giving explanations. Mm-hmm. There is, I think, quite a strong perception in some areas that the UN is being useless. Why isn't it in sorting out Syria and name other 40 places? And when you try and explain to the people, for example, the London cabbie who has raised this view, that you can't just walk into Syria because of Russia and the Security Council, they go, oh, I never knew that. And there's also the perception that UN staff live in gold-plated palaces and earn an awful lot of money. And I think there's all kinds of things which does the UN no great service. among Daily Mail readers, for example, which could so easily be overcome without it looking like lies and porkies, if I may use a reference to our Prime Minister. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been recorded for posterity.
Yeah. Yes, is there an editor, Edward, of this, these proceedings?
That's wonderful. I just wanted to just mention, David earlier talked about ethnic issues. In a sense, it's all about the human agency, which is all about the kind of transformations that are going on. So I think in an indirect way, this whole question of ethnicity was touched on. But that said, let me just go back to Judith's point about, if you like, bolting in from the blue. In one sense, I do take your point, I mean, coming also from a historical background. But the speed of change now is unprecedented. And I think it would be difficult to say that the same level and type of continuity will be what we have seen in the past. And I just wondered now if we are really talking about a different kind of speed. Let me, because of what I tried
Can
to say...
I just make one point?
Please.
Remember that international law is likely to carry on a great many of the ideas and cultural implications. And that's where you need to look for a carryover. Because you're
Thank
not
you.
Going to simply dispense with the system of law.
Very interesting point. It's, let me just say, by the way, having my father having signed, if you like, the Outer Space Convention 3 or 4 decades ago, it's completely irrelevant. So it depends upon the kind of law that you're talking about. That said, let me just quickly mention and go back to this. Edward, one's not trying to say that, if you like, the UN has to create this. It's the looking towards the kind of future that we should be thinking about. What I'm saying is that the UN has, if you like, an ability to bring together this kind of knowledge, this kind of wisdom, and that's just perhaps reflecting what Michael said. The whole question, Mukesh, is not, let me just emphasize, nothing to do with futurology. I don't know, for example, what I'm doing tomorrow, but I do know that one has to be sensitive to the what might be's. And that's what we're suggesting for organizations of the future, because unless you do, if you take a look at where you're working and what kind of things you're doing, you will be, if you like, well marginalized by the private sector, by diaspora, by networks, by a whole host of entities, which, if you like, makes the UN very much a, if you like, second-rate factor, which we don't want. There are roles the UN can play, but I haven't seen them coming together yet.
Well, please thank our two speakers, and then the program is imposed. The program is imposed on me a duty of winding up in 10 minutes, which will take us just a few minutes over 5:30, is that permissible? But still in good time for taxis. And the first thing to say is that this is, in a sense, an ongoing process, this seminar is. And any of you who have could supply a witness brief additional to those we already have is very welcome to do so. Or anybody who has particular points that need to be put into any report that is made and pointed in the direction of the World Humanitarian Summit can do so. And in either case, they can be sent care of Askwith, A-S-K-W-I-T-H.
Yes.
Sorry,
A-S-K.
W-I-T-H. Underline. Michael, you're looking rather surprised. At yahoo.co.uk. So it's very much an ongoing process, and my concluding remarks will not be the last words on this seminar. What have we learnt from the witness briefs and from this seminar? Well, speaking personally, I would say an enormous amount, and on a wide range of topics to do with humanitarian action, and I can't sum them up all in these brief few minutes. I'll just mention a few particular issues at the end. But first, a comment on the big picture. The United Nations, whatever else it is or isn't, is an organisation that adapts. Humanitarian action is barely alluded to in the Charter. It was not an initial part of the UN's remit. And yet it has become an absolutely major part of its activity today. And yes, that is quite largely due to two developments. One is the fundamental change, and here David Harland was right, there has been a very fundamental change in the nature of conflict. The problem the UN was created to address, above all, was the problem of international war. And whether it's because of the UN, or nuclear weapons, or international law, or whatever, the problem of international war has undoubtedly receded somewhat. There has been a lesser frequency of it. And dealing with civil war is the problem the UN has had to address. And as has been said more than once today, dealing with civil wars presents peculiarly difficult problems for international organisations. Conceptually, if one country attacks another, as Iraq in Kuwait, it's relatively straightforward. Addressing a civil war is an enormously complex problem. It always has been a difficult problem for international organisations, and it is so in the present era. And incidentally, one of my many reasons for being nervous about new eraism, and here I'm with you, is that while, yes, there are amazing dramatic changes taking place in the world, we should not assume that they're taking place in anything like a uniform manner or affecting the way people think in a uniform manner. On the contrary, they have very opposite effects on the ways people think. And part of the problem of the interventions of recent years has been the lazy assumption that we are in a new era where people will welcome a foreign occupier who offers to bring democracy to their country and will go along with the project. And that has turned out not to be the case. And indeed, the reaction of Afghans to foreign involvement, or Iraqis, has followed fairly traditional lines of reactions to external control. So we ignore historical memory at our peril. And if new era talk implies, which it doesn't need to, a belief that everything is different now, then we're going to let ourselves in for trouble. And there has been extraordinary change in other organisations too. The UNHCR's involvement in protecting internally displaced people was a major change in the function of the organisation in the 1990s compared to the previous main preoccupation. And that was particularly, of course, triggered by the events in former Yugoslavia and involved it in a new kind of involvement in humanitarian action. And one conceptual point arising from all of that in Yugoslavia is that the word protection is used in two completely different senses, and it's caused immense muddle. And one of the many pleas one might make of a World Humanitarian Summit is to try and get that straight. This isn't mere pedantry. There is a colossal difference between talking of protection in terms of legal status of protection as against talking of protection in terms of physical protection. And the two issues were totally muddled up in the title of UNPROFOR, for example, in former Yugoslavia. That's an issue that needs to be addressed. One of the consequences of the changes that there have been in the increased role of humanitarian action has been we've had several attempts at doctrine to describe and give guidance in the new situation. I'm thinking particularly of responsibility to protect and then rights up front, the doctrine propounded by Ban Ki-moon following the Sri Lanka fiasco. And in both of these cases, it has to be said, doctrine has run into serious trouble. The attempt to get a global generalisation out of these problems has proved very, very difficult and arouses what one might call antibodies, not only within the system, but in international relations more generally. And sinister copycat phenomena, like the way in which Putin has justified some of the Russian actions in Georgia and Ukraine, in language which is remarkably similar to responsibility to protect. And that brings me actually to a basic point that does need emphasising, which is that the United Nations isn't just, as Professor Kapila said, as it were, a moral entity, but it is, as John Holmes and others have said, also very much still an organisation of sovereign states. And it's that superimposition of two different systems of values, the system of the world of sovereign states and the world of human rights, that is proving peculiarly difficult to manage. Now, briefly, what lessons for the World Humanitarian Summit? I will give them in headline form. One, I think there's a need to respect foreign states and societies, and has been said here vigorously, not assume any kind of humanitarian superiority. And that takes the form, for example, of respecting sometimes different and uncongenial cultures, sometimes ones that we might regard as not humanitarian, but changing other people's cultures at a single blow is an extraordinarily difficult task. And sometimes softly works better. And very little has been said. Only one of the briefs referred to language issues, and there's been one mention of language issues, or perhaps two today, in the discussion. But I think one of the characteristics of current Western involvements and Northern involvements, if you like, in many of the conflicts of the present era is precisely the short-term involvement of many of those who are taking part, and the lack of involvement in the local culture. And we were just discussing over tea how the proportion of time spent looking at your computer screen as against talking with locals is sometimes less than ideal. Thirdly, protecting civilians, which has become a key humanitarian issue, and rightly so, should be recognised explicitly as being an extraordinarily difficult task. It's very difficult to achieve, especially when Western armies are not in a mood to put boots on the ground any more than they have to. But even if they are, it's a very difficult move to achieve. And it almost always requires having local allies, which itself challenges a particular notion of impartiality. If there's a civil war going on, or internal conflict, as in Libya, it may have been necessary to work with one side rather than not. And the idea that there was a completely non-aligned, a completely neutral way of achieving protection seems to me to be a dream. I agree with all that has been said about collaboration and coordination, a nervousness about grand schemes for it, but the importance of doing it. And all I can say is one of the aspects that has very much struck me is there are certain humanitarian crises where everybody, every NGO in the world wants to be present. And it's a piece of humanitarian madness. Sarajevo immediately after the war, there wasn't an NGO that didn't want to be there. Likewise in Kosovo, and that's one aspect of what is a very serious problem. Whistleblowing has come up several times today. It seems to me that it has an absolutely crucial role in the system and needs to be managed much better than it has been. And lastly, before I say a few words of thanks, the financing of humanitarian action. The seriousness of the crisis, I think we all know it in this room, and therefore we haven't said much about it. But that absolutely needs to be addressed. And the fact that there is a great deal to criticise in the way humanitarian action has operated, the fact that there are difficult debates about its future, doesn't take away from the urgent need to do something about the financing system. Whether that means going over to another fundamentally different way of raising funds, one can doubt. I don't think there's a magic bullet in this area, but it is a point that needs absolutely underlining. Now, because I'm late, let me just thank, first of all, Edward Mortimer for his major role in organising this as president of BAFUNCS and as a leading expert on the mysterious ways of the United Nations. Martin Barber, who has put a great deal of hard thinking into organising this seminar and getting the right people here and the right speakers and making it the interesting occasion that it was. And if he succeeds in making the World Humanitarian Summit half as interesting, he will have done a magnificent job. I want to thank Wilma Menti of the Bodleian, who, as you all know, has done a terrific job in getting us all here. And, of course, our various hosts and sponsors.